Blog Talk Radio.
Lincoln 103 and 102.
Responding to 401 parking structure, section 1 boy.
Henry 8, Henry 9, respond to gate 437 Bravo for your dignitary detail. 3K911, unattended 400 lower level near carousel 4, black bag. GTA in progress, 401 parking structure, section 4 boy.
Responding to 401 parking structure, section 1 boy.
415 passenger onboard aircraft.
Charles 2 Franklin and Brown.
484 suspect, the female, Hispanic, 28 years of age. Blue G, no further.
Control, high Frank, 401 is a route.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to this edition of the Private Officer Beat Radio. I'm your host, Rick McCann, founder and CEO of Private Officer International. I say that not for the listeners, not for my regulars, but of course for those who might be stopping by for the first time, and because it's something that we in radio do. We identify ourselves. You can't see us on the screen. You don't know who's behind the microphone, but now you do. So we've made it to another Friday, another long weekend coming up for some folks, and a lot of things happening as we start moving into the warmer weather. We go from the kind of colder winter, early spring, and now we're really zipping right into summer months almost. I know in our neck of the woods here in North Carolina, we've seen days at 88 degrees. And we've seen nights as low as in the 40s all within the same week. So we're kind of in that weather pattern where we're not sure if it's going to be a warm summer day or a cold, chilly night. But nonetheless, we are moving steadily right into summertime. With that, we talked about last week, this time of year, with this type of flux, in between the spring and the winter, and the summer, we get cold, we get warm. Across the nation, unfortunately, that brings a lot of different types of storms. In Denver, they had snow. A number of other states got as much as 20 inches over the last few days. And, of course, there were more than 60 outbreaks of tornadoes this week across the Midlands of the country, across the middle of the U.S., and more coming this weekend, so we're already talking about that, preparing for it, because between the southeast mid-Atlantic area where we operate mainly, we see that wide variance of weather. So we're going to be prepared. There could be a tornado or two in our area. We're definitely looking at thunderstorms and a change in the weather, a little bit cooler temperature, so we're standing by for that. And hopefully all that will be out of here quickly, and we'll move right back into that great 88, 90-degree summer weather. We hope that wherever you're at, that you're experiencing decent weather and a good week, and that you've got some good plans for the weekend. I know myself, I'm going to be going out to look at some local baseball, and we're also going to be doing some training. The rest of the month, I'll be on the road quite a bit. I got about 8 or 9 different training seminars and courses that we're doing this month, so I will be out of the office a lot traveling, as I often do, spending more than 100 days in hotels on the road every year, sometimes more than that. I kind of feel like a rock and roll singer or country singer, out on the road. All I need now is my own RV, fully stocked, and I'll be good to go. Maybe that'll be next year, but, we're growing so fast, it's just sometimes you just want to stay at home. But it's all part of the gig, part of the job, and so we happily do it. We have a lot to share with you today. Of course, we got a lot of breaking news, just like always. I do want to mention, however, the shooting this week in Charlotte, North Carolina, where we're based out of. Unfortunately, another active shooter, this time at the University of North Carolina in Charlotte. This happened Tuesday, I believe it was, and it was just out of nowhere. They had no incidents. They had no signs that anyone was upset or that there would be a active shooter incident. But luckily for them, that they had done numerous active shooter trainings with the University Police Department and the CMPD, the Charlotte Mecklenburg Police Department. And so a lot of the people on campus, both the faculty and the students, had some knowledge as to the run, hide, fight, you know, situation and how to get into a locked room and make it dark and hide and stay quiet. And many did. Unfortunately, two people were killed. Four others were shot, one of which has just come out of the hospital late yesterday. And the shooter, the suspect, was taken into custody very quickly. Among those dead, a student in the classroom who many, including myself, are calling a hero, and he jumped up and he was able to tackle the man before he was shot and killed. And he was a ROTC member, which is a reserve officer for the Army. And so that slowed the gunman down long enough for campus police to get into the classroom and take the suspect into custody. He also emptied his clip, so he had no more bullets in that clip. And they're not saying if he had any more with him at all. He might have had another magazine. He might have had some ammo in his pocket, but law enforcement are not releasing those details yet. But because of that brave student, I did give police a chance to run in and get that suspect into custody. Campus police, at least three or four officers, one sergeant and one lieutenant, was Johnny on the spot, and they really got in there within moments of being made aware of the situation, and that also prevented many, many others from being killed or wounded. And so between the hero student and the hero law enforcement, it was over before it started almost, and unfortunately there was loss of life, but thankfully it wasn't as bad as it could have been. It's a sad moment in the U.S. and around the world right now, because these attacks are not going away anytime soon. They're only really beginning to escalate, and you know, you never know where it's going to be. It could be at the mall. It could be at a school. It could be at the church. It could be at a fish fry. You never know. Eight people were shot also in Virginia over the weekend, and it was at a large outdoor event. No one died, so it didn't really make a whole lot of news or a whole lot of headlines. But these things are happening more frequently, and that's why we always want to reiterate that it's important that you get not only training, but that you have more understanding of the mindset of who these people are, so that you're able to assess your own personal safety when you're out and about, whether it be at a restaurant or a movie theater or the mall or just out having a good time at a park. Understanding and knowing what to look for, what looks suspicious, who looks out of place. One of the things that they did say in this latest shooting at the University of North Carolina, Charlotte, you know, he looked out of place. He was a student, but no one recognized him. He came in as the class was already in progress. He sat down in the class, and he had a backpack. And although he kind of looked out of place and people realized that he did, they continued on with the class, and suddenly he arose and pulled a gun from, I guess, a backpack or his waist and began to unload on those students. It's important that we understand where we're at. It's important to assess those threats, those dangers. It's important to know what we're looking at and be able to process it in our mind. Is this someone who is acting suspicious? Are their movements, their actions, their demeanor suspicious? It's important for us to be able to quickly assess it and get out of harm's way. If it's somebody that we're not comfortable being around, we need to leave. If that means leave the class, leave the school, leave the mall, wherever we're at, then that's what you do. That's how you stay safe. Go and call law enforcement. Get them involved. It's unfortunate, but it is what it is. It is that time that we're living in, and we have to be very, very, very conscious of our surrounding at all the time. And it's even more so when you work in security or law enforcement or public safety. Don't underestimate what you're looking at, what you're seeing, what you're thinking, or what you are feeling. You know that old saying, you know, I just had that feeling in my gut. It's a gut feeling. Go with it. The hairs on the back of my neck just stood up when he entered the room. Go with it. I just had this funny feeling when I heard, when I saw. Go with it. It's important that we really trust our feelings, trust our training, trust, you know, our assessment, our ability to assess situations so that we can get out of harm's way and help others. I have a lot to say about these type of events because I do not believe that schools and malls and churches and other places that are public spaces are protecting people well enough. I don't believe that they're doing enough. Schools, I believe in this day and age, need to have metal detectors, just like the airport. They need to lock all exit doors and have a one-way in, one-way out at the front where the security people are. They need to have roaming armed security and really pay a lot more attention to who's on the properties, but they don't. And because of this, and even the police chief here at UNCC said, unfortunately, we choose to have an open campus. We don't have gates. We don't have access control. You know, we don't have a fence completely around our perimeter. The University of North Carolina in 2019 has 27,000 students, 5,000 faculty. That's a small city, 32,000. We have many schools, many colleges, universities across the country that have even more. We have churches that have 15 and 20,000. 5,000 is no big deal anymore. You have large malls. You have large facilities, sporting facilities, amusement parks that have tens of thousands of people. And so it is, in my opinion, their responsibility to keep everybody safe. Well, that's me on the soapbox today, me preaching, hopefully to the choir, but that's really my feeling. And my many years of experience in this business tells me that we really need to start taking things more serious and be more vigilant and be prepared for it to happen more often in the most unsuspected places. All right, what else do we have coming up today? We talked last week a little bit about mental health emergencies, responding, assessing, recognizing. And we also talked about a medical term last week that, you know, a lot of people are not too aware of. And this week we're talking again on mental health. We're talking about how to evaluate it, how to identify when it really is a mental health issue. We have a little clip from a seminar that we participated in, and we're going to play that as well. And over the next couple of weeks, we have several other programs. We have something that we're doing that is going to, I hope, enhance your own career, and something that we're going to be offering, and we'll be announcing more about that next week. A lot of things happening, just, you know, not only for us, but across the country. A lot of political problems, a lot of chaos, a lot of problems in our government. We have wars around us. We have a huge illegal immigration problem, which won't go away, but people try to pretend like it's not a problem. It is a problem, and that problem affects us on the front line, whether you're security, law enforcement, or just, you know, a private citizen. But we are going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about what's happening in the news. As you know, there's always a lot of stuff happening in the news. And then when we get done with that, we're going to talk a little bit about mental health emergencies. I do want to remind you before I go away here on this first break that we are still having our 2019 uniform and patrol car contest. Best dressed officer and best looking patrol car. Send those pictures in to helpdesk@privateofficer.com. Helpdesk@privateofficer.com. That ends this week, so be sure to get those in. And in a couple of weeks, our annual officer appreciation and awards program will be coming up, so we'll announce that as well. If you're not a member of Private Officer, be sure to go to our website, privateofficer.org. Sign up today. Lots of benefits, huge support, and you'll become part of our family. We also want to recognize our sponsor, Body Armor USA. We've got what it takes to cover you, whether you're looking for protective clothing, body armor, gloves, whether you work in corrections, law enforcement, security, whatever it might be. Call us today. Go to our website, bodyarmorusa.com. Let them know that you heard all about us here at the Private Officer Radio. They're going to give you a discount on your purchase. All right, we're coming right back. Do not go away. You're not going to want to miss everything else that's happening.
Doing drugs is like being on top of the world. Everyone says so. Everyone seems to be having one dandy old time. Hey, it's part of growing up. Or is it? Just think about this. Before you go and do something you've never done before, you just better know what you're jumping into.
Fantastic day.
What a fantastic day.
The water is like glass.
The water is like glass.
Don't forget the soda.
Don't forget the life jacket.
Who wants the 8 and who wants the 15?
Who wants the inflatables?
What a great day.
To be on the water.
So glad you saw me go over.
That was so funny when you went over and your life jacket inflated.
Never go out without a life jacket on again.
What a great day we had.
When it comes to wearing life jackets, make the right choice. You're in command. Vote responsibly. This message brought to you by the National Safe Boating Council and the U.S. Coast Guard.
The news desk this morning, I'm pretty sure we're going to be able to rustle up some breaking news because there's always plenty of breaking news coming in here. Coming out of Indiana, Chicago man wrestled with court security right there in the courtroom this Monday, and as he did so, he was holding his infant son who went flying onto the floor through the court, Christopher Jackson, who was sentenced for a handgun violation, now is facing new charges after that scuffle with court security. In Ladue, Missouri, a St. Louis County grand jury has indicted a police officer for a shooting that occurred at the Ladue Crossing Shopping Center where he wrestled with a shoplifter and the officer shot the person. He was charged with second-degree assault in the indictment. This is the first officer involved shooting of in the history of this small town police department, and the officer will be facing trial in the near future. Also in the breaking news coming out of Coweta County, Georgia, that is outside of the metro Atlanta area, but an off-duty deputy sheriff, brand new officer. He had previously been a detention officer, and he was promoted to become a deputy sheriff, and he was in the process of going through the academy. He was shot to death over the weekend by a relative. A dispute erupted, and the sheriff's department says that he was shot and killed while off duty during that dispute. Anchorage police are thanking an alert security officer today after he spotted a stolen vehicle that a bolo had been put out on earlier in the week. Police were able to respond quickly and box in the driver of that stolen vehicle and take him into custody. Police say had it not been for that alert security officer, the car may not have been found, or it may have been stripped down. Authorities in Pasco County, Florida, say that a school resource officer's firearm did go off accidentally inside the cafeteria on Tuesday. The incident happening at the Waitman Middle School in Wesley Chapel. A sheriff deputy for the Pasco County Sheriff's Department said he was leaning up against a wall in the cafeteria during lunch hour when the gun, a Sig Sauer 9mm, did accidentally discharge, but really, they don't know why, because it was holstered. They are tearing that gun apart, and they are looking at what caused it to fire. In Chicago, Illinois, police there are investigating the shooting death of an off-duty security officer who got into a dispute earlier in the day with a female over a former boyfriend. They're not really sure what happened. She was found later in the day in an alley. Lika Armstrong, who wanted to become a deputy sheriff or get into law enforcement, was found dead. That investigation is still underway at this hour. In Middlesex County, New Jersey, a former school security officer was sentenced to jail for 7 years. Elias Aguilera, 26, is facing 7 years now in prison for sexual assault of a minor. In Dayton, Ohio, police there arrested a 18-year-old man after attacking Dayton library security officers and others. They said that he just started fighting for no reason. Security tried to detain him, and he punched one of the security officers in the head and assaulted another second security officer. Police were able to arrive quick enough and get him into custody. Here in Metro Charlotte, North Carolina, we're still dealing with the aftermath of an active shooter that occurred earlier this week. Two people were left dead, four injured at the University of North Carolina, Charlotte. We do know that the suspect, a former student at the school, 22-year-old Tristan Tyrrell, had no explanation for the murders, and that it's still under investigation. During the shooting in the classroom, a student did jump up and tackle the suspect, giving officers time to get in and take him into custody with no other shots, but that student was also killed. In Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, a court security officer who is from a private company is under investigation after he allowed a woman to enter the building with a firearm. The security company called AmGuard is also under investigation and may lose their contract. The female was arrested and charged with carrying a gun in an unauthorized city building. In Charlotte, North Carolina, a security officer is also under investigation after accidentally firing a firearm while in a verbal altercation with several people outside of a restaurant. He pulled his gun, and while putting it back into his holster, it went off. The North Carolina Private Protective Service Board, which oversees private security in North Carolina, are investigating the situation. It was announced this week in Sarasota County, Florida, that the County School Police Department will be taking over all security in all of the schools in the county. contrary to what initially was thought was going to be the school police would only handle county schools, they have now decided that they would be assigned to all elementary and high schools within the jurisdiction of the county. Also in the news, you may have seen this on the TV or in your newspaper, Amazon. Of course, Amazon's already involved in many different areas, but now they're hiring reporters. They're starting their own online crime report. And Amazon, which has bought out a security ring security alarm for about $1 billion previously, now wants to be part of the Crime News Network. A student has been charged after a gun went off earlier this week in Prince William County, Virginia. That's up toward the northern part of Virginia. The student brought the gun to school, and it went off. He's been arrested. The 16-year-old was taken into custody after the incident. Nobody was hurt. Another incident involving another Charlotte, North Carolina security company. This one, the state of North Carolina has closed down completely a security company after, in March, one of their employees who was not licensed to carry a firearm fired 16 rounds at suspects during an attempted robbery at a state employee's credit union. While initially it was thought that he was heroic, now after an investigation, police, CMPD, has said that he was reckless. The North Carolina Private Protection Board got involved and said he was not licensed to carry a gun, and they have since closed down the company in Charlotte, North Carolina. Thankfully, the FBI was on their toes, and they were able to stop a chilling terror plot in Long Beach, California. An Army vet there planned to do harm to many people in the area during a white supremacist rally. Mark Stephen Domingo, 26, a former soldier who served in Afghanistan, has been arrested for terror plots. Also coming out this week in the news, someone took a sack of moose poop through TSA lines at the airport in Juneau, Alaska, is the capital. And according to authorities, this was part of a protest against the governor's new stinky budget proposal. TSA said there's no violations of taking waste, human or animal, through the line as long as it gets checked, which it did, and they released him. No other problems, and he went about his way. In Boston, a woman there has been charged with threatening a mall security officer with a disease-ridden needle after she was being stopped for a shoplifting incident within the mall. Kim Rogers, 37, faces aggravated assault charges after she took items off the shelf, filled two bags, and attempted to walk out with $1,600 worth of jewelry, fragrances, and other items. She's currently being held on a $2,000 bond. Also in the news, a Florida man coming out of Tampa, Florida today, a Florida man accused of stealing more than $5,000 in several incidents at Walmart, is now blaming his diabetes. Lawrence Figueroa Jr. says, well, he doesn't remember all of this, and he's quite sure he didn't steal it, but if he did, it was his diabetes that caused him to do this. Many are reporting that the new TSA screening body scanner systems are seeing way too much, and they are asking the TSA do something about that. According to documents, the TSA is reviewing at this time the quality of their machines and whether or not it is accessing way too much. Also in the news today, we have a report of a security officer being shot in Metro Atlanta, Georgia, DeKalb County. Police say the security officer who was on duty at an apartment complex was shot after confronting a male who was trespassing on the property. Always a lot of news. Las Vegas, Nevada, police there who have arrested a 16-year-old boy in the deadly shooting of a 75-year-old security officer, Anthony Okaberry, is being held on a $1 million bond after he was charged with the murder of a 75-year-old security officer at an apartment complex earlier last week. Authorities in Florida say that they are closer to allowing teachers to carry guns in the classroom. The law is expected to pass later this month. In New York, if you are unemployed or underemployed, there's a new way for you to make new income. The New York Environmental Police are giving rewards to people who report idling vehicles, trucks, buses, delivery trucks, or even vehicles, cars, sitting and idling within the city is a criminal offense, and they want to know about it. If you call them and they get there and write a ticket, you will receive 25% of the fine. Four people right now in the city have made in excess of $5,000 each by making these calls and collecting the reward. Coming out of Sevierville, Tennessee, up in Gatlinburg, four suspects are in custody after a shoplifting spree of more than $20,000 worth of merchandise from multiple stores at the Tanger Five Oaks Mall there in the Gatlinburg region. Those four suspects are being held on a $150,000 bond. Syracuse also had an incident of a shoplifting spree. Two women there charged with multiple thousands of dollars worth of theft at the Ithaca Mall. An Alaskan bank employee has been charged with stealing $4.3 million from an Alaska bank, and they almost got away with it, according to the U.S. Attorney General. According to the U.S. Attorney General, prosecutors say that the suspect fled to Mexico with the money. Authorities worked to apprehend Gerardo Correas, known as Gary Correas, after the theft from the banks in Alaska during the 2011 through the 2013. He is in federal custody. A Charlotte, North Carolina manager, security manager at the Epicenter Bar, was stabbed over the weekend by a suspect that he got into a confrontation with. That suspect has been apprehended, and the security guard will be released from the hospital this week. Cincinnati, Ohio. Authorities there say that they want to add drug detection canines to the schools. The Lebanon City School District and the Lebanon Police Department have announced a joint venture to place drug detection dogs at the junior highs and at the senior highs because of the numerous calls for drug cases on the properties. Always a lot of news. Send us your news tips and information to the Help Desk Private Officer, helpdesk@privateofficer.com. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we've got a whole lot more to share with you here on this week's Private Officer Beat Radio.
For some children, America isn't the land of promise. It's a place where every day is a struggle. Because today, in America, one in six children lives below the poverty line. For these children, living in poverty means going without medicine, going without food, going without a warm home, or even a roof over your head. And that's life for nearly 13 million children of all races, all across America. Where will you draw the line and get involved? You can help these children and their families find a way out of poverty for good. And you can make a difference in more ways than you think. Will you help? Go to povertyusa.org today. Because one in six children in poverty is one too many. A message...
21-3-172,
no water warrant.
Some of the public, and by the way, welcome as well. Sorry, welcome as well to all the individuals who have checked in and the departments that have checked in. Some of the public are very disillusioned about the reality of force in the police world. In a study on university students' perception of police use of force that we just conducted, out of approximately 400 subjects across five different campuses, the average student reported law enforcement use of deadly force at a rate of 1 out of 5 citizen encounters. Wow, is that unrealistic? Now, they get that from many different sources, primarily television. But the reality is, from multiple studies involving over 20 million law enforcement citizen contacts, 20 million, the studies inform us that actual use of force is less than 0.1%. And that is in all citizen encounters, less than 0.1%. In all criminal arrests, the use of force is less than 1%, with very few reported injuries. However, society has seen lawful but awful incidences, particularly under the intense scrutiny and criticism of the press. And they are now asking officers to perform at a higher level, though they don't really know how or what that is. At the same time, officers are more frequently being called to respond to incidences involving people with mental illness, disorganized thinking, or in a personal crisis. And just like all other problems, society is seeking a simple solution to a very complicated and difficult problem. And that solution they're seeking is labeled de-escalation. People can't define de-escalation, but they believe they will know it when they see it. And this is important. Not all people who call for the police to use de-escalation really understand it themselves. De-escalation is not some magic formula or words that can turn all rational but uncooperative criminal suspects into cooperative ones. It's also not something that magically allows officers to successfully communicate with a person who is so profoundly in crisis that they're unresponsive to anything outside of themselves. How does force science see de-escalation? Well, for this, we need to attribute it to one of our presenters, Bill Everett, an attorney, who has labeled it a systems-based approach. And this is agency-wide. It's an agency-wide systems approach for using opportunities, knowledge, skills, and abilities to resolve problems with minimal harm, not minimal force, and to do that where possible, which means there has to be an opportunity for it to occur. Doctors cannot promise to save everyone's life, and officers can't promise to resolve every situation without harm, but they will try their best if there is an opportunity to do so. And this systems-based approach includes the use of specific communications, but not just communications. It also involves behavioral tactics to diffuse potentially violent encounters and use time to slow things down to reduce risk to both the officer and the others. The basic task is to provide psychological first aid, just like you do medical first aid. The purpose is not to do therapy or to provide therapy, but to provide an effective transition from the street to treatment. Now, one issue that causes confusion is that those advocating de-escalation often fail to distinguish between a person in a crisis and a criminal suspect. De-escalation is most appropriate when there's a person in crisis. And it's not that you'd never use de-escalation or conflict communications on criminal suspects, but caution must be used in that you do not necessarily want to lose the first and possibly best opportunity to take the person into custody. When you have a non-compliant criminal suspect, de-escalation tactics can actually backfire, slowing things down, and give them the advantage and increase the risk to you. With a person in crisis, slowing things down and employing de-escalation tactics may reduce the risk to you and to them. And that's a goal. Of course, someone can be both a criminal suspect and a person in crisis. Now, simply, society appears to view those law enforcement encounters in the street, those that law enforcement encounter in the street, as falling within one of two categories, those who are criminals and those who are in a mental health crisis. With those who are criminal, you use conflict communication. And with those in a crisis, you use crisis communication. Then everything will de-escalate and resolve itself without force. And you know it's not as simple as that.
All right, thanks, Bill. I'm going to get into transition a little bit into what the law requires. And this is going to take a little prep here to get started. First off, as Shannon mentioned right at the beginning, this is not legal advice, and there's just no way in the few minutes, the limited time that we have here, to do a comprehensive overview of how all the various circuit courts, federal circuit courts, that cases for all the people that are on this call. There's no way to go through them all. So that's the first thing. This is just going to be, we're going to talk about a couple of different cases, and we're primarily using them because they make sense. And the concepts are pretty sound. The other thing you have to understand is that what most of the cases that deal with excessive force cases, for instance, most of these cases are cases involving a review of a district court for granting summary judgment. So in other words, just to make this as simple as possible, the municipality involved is making a motion to dismiss a case because assuming everything, and this is important, assuming everything the plaintiff says, there's something in this suit, says is true, there's no constitutional violation, or if there was a constitutional violation, the right was not clearly established prior to the incident. So, and that's important to understand because when I do talk about, like, for instance, the Rowell case, the other point that I'm going to make is I might say the names wrong, so I apologize. But some of you might be familiar with these cases and you might think, well, wait a minute, that's not exactly what happened. Well, here's the reality of the way the law works. When it comes to these types of review, that is what happened. The court has to take the plaintiff's view. So anyway, let's get into the Rowell case here. So the answer to this question, essentially, and this is a oversimplification, but the answer to this question, does the law require the use of de-escalation tactics? The answer is generally no. However, it is, as you'll see as we go through, that it's a little more complicated than that. I will try to tie this all together for you so you'll have something to work with. So, but this quote right out of the Rowell case is, no case law prohibits officers from using physical force without attempting de-escalation techniques. And just because a person, like for instance, in this particular case, Rowell was in what appeared to be a state of excited delirium. He's had a t-shirt on. He was had a garden hose in his hand that he was whipping around with it sounds like a faucet on the end of it. He had some type of planter in his other hand. He had broken some windows in a neighbor's house. The police were called. The officers responded. And he advanced on the officers, swinging the hose. The officers arced their taser. They gave him warnings. And I'm just kind of simplifying this, but gave him warnings to get him to stop. He wouldn't stop. He finally got him. Got near them. They tased him. They ended up engaging him physically, trying to use restraint tactics. Ultimately, he was run out of sleep, and he subsequently passed away. So, you know, it's a tragedy. It's definitely a tragic case. But the court ruled that in this case, this was objectively reasonable under these circumstances. And it's helpful to take a look at a prior precedent, the Martin case, on the next slide, that where the court compared the behaviors. And I like this because it, I think, really demonstrates how the courts, in a broad view, will look at the cases. So when you look at the contrast here, well, just very quickly, in Martin, what happened was Martin is somewhat similar to start with, naked, battling, tried to get into a woman's apartment. The police are called. They respond. He comes running across the grass towards them. He turns and puts his hands behind him and says, "Take me to jail," or something to that effect. But before the officers can get to him, he starts to jog away. Well, the officers ran after him. They didn't give any warnings. They tackled him. And again, this is the depiction in the case, is that multiple strikes and blows to the head, hammer blows and so forth, as they were described by the officers, and attempts to control him. And they had the weight of, at one point, three different officers on, three total officers on top of him, and ultimately he also passed away. So the comparison here is good because, especially with the first bullets, as you can see here, in Roel, they tried to communicate with him. So this is where, as Bill has already mentioned, you're not always going to be able to effectively communicate with a person. However, these cases, there's other cases, people that are familiar with Armstrong versus Pinehurst in the 10th Circuit, Perea versus Baca, Berea was the 10th Circuit, Armstrong, I think, was the 4th Circuit. Similar things where the court focused on communication. And like in Perea, there was no attempt at communication, similar to Martin. They just kind of tackled him off of his bike and ended up engaged with him physically without any attempts. Pinehurst, there was effective communication until a commitment order was signed, and then it was like a switch was turned, and that's it, you're going. And that's what led to the struggle that ultimately led to his death. So if you kind of look at it this way, in the terms of what we're going to talk about shortly with priority of life, who's bringing the risk? So in Roel, it was Roel bringing the risk to the officers. In Martin and in Pinehurst and Perea, it was more the officers bringing the risk to him, so to speak. So there, I think this is a telling person as to communication warning, the type of physicality used in Roel. It was more attempts to subdue, restrain arms, restrain legs, as compared to using multiple strikes and blows. And the reality is that a person in a state of excited delirium is not necessarily going to feel the pain, and those blows are not necessarily going to be effective. All right, so now we got to look at, but is there a legal distinction between a person in crisis and a criminal suspect? And, you know, again, the answer on a very superficial level is no. There is no strict legal distinction. In other words, right now, there is no rule that says you if a person is in crisis, you must handle them this way as compared to a criminal suspect. However, as in the Durrell case, the mental state of the individual is a factor that must be considered when determining the objective reasonableness of the force used. So it fits in together. It fits in with the structure that we already have, that the Graham versus Connor analysis that everybody's used to. I'm sure virtually everybody on this call, that has been the law of the land since you were police officers. Now, in this case, this is another interesting case as far as communication and warnings. And Durrell was in crisis. The police had set up a perimeter around the houses in the area. He had been wandering around for about a half an hour. He had complied with prior instructions by the officers. They were set up on the perimeter. They were waiting for negotiators to come. And then one officer decided that he needed to venture into within the perimeter to reconnoiter the situation. So he did that. He had a shotgun armed loaded with beanbag rounds. Durrell started to come towards the officer, and he told him to stop, and he ended up firing a beanbag round that impacted in his eye and actually lodged in his eye, causing him to lose the eye and, you know, some other injuries. So the court focused on the fact that, you know, again, typical in a Graham analysis, that he really hadn't committed a crime. There was a bunch of officers on the scene already for a half an hour before he shot him. He had an opportunity to observe him for a period of time before firing, there was no real need for him to be where he was, is essentially the way to warn, and no warning was given. So this particular case, the court allowed this to go to trial. So now with that background, so here's where we are right now. And next we're going to consider, when should we legally then consider de-escalation? So here's where we are so far. Is it legally required? No. But is it a consideration? Yes. Now, before we get into this part, I got to make this clear. We are not telling you that, and the Roa case doesn't stand for the fact that you shouldn't use de-escalation. What officers have to understand, because as Bill pointed out already, there's such misconception about out there as to what de-escalation is. And the last thing we want is officers to hesitate to use force when it's necessary to objectively reasonable and necessary to protect themselves or a third party. That is, we cannot let officers get to that situation. So that's why you have to understand it. So now, when should we consider it? Well, do you have discretionary time? Do you have time to think? Who is at risk and who is causing the risk? And that's going to lead us into priority of life. But the first thing that we have to do is just very, very quickly cover a very complex area of law also. And that is there a legal duty to prevent a person from harming themselves? And the answer, again, is generally no, there isn't. And that the Cheney case, there set forth there is no obligation of the state to protect an individual against private violence. That includes self, that would include self. Is there a moral duty? Sure there is, to a point. But it's important to understand, because we don't want officers making decisions about tactics that they're going to use under the wrong assumptions. Because it comes to this: if you decide to act, then liability may result from the course of action and how whatever happens as a result of that course of action. So the Glenn versus Washington County case, just very, very quickly, young man emotionally upset. He's holding a knife to his neck. The parents and friends call the police. Sergeant working the road is over the radio trying to set up a staging area for the responding officers. However, two of the officers bypass the staging area. Lucas is standing apparently in the driveway holding a knife up to his neck. And the officer, the first officer, and then shortly followed by the second officer, come running down the driveway with their guns out, screaming. Again, this is the way it's depicted in the case, screaming at him to drop the gun, drop the knife, or they're going to kill him. So the second officer comes, it takes up a similar posture. Now the family and friends are trying to de-escalate the officers. They get into the house, come up with a plan. This all happens within a few minutes. They come up with a plan to fire beanbag rounds at him, but if he moves towards the house, they're going to shoot him. So they fire the beanbag rounds, and he does move towards the house, and they end up shooting him. Once again, case in this particular case is allowed to proceed to a jury. So you don't want to be the one escalating the situation, because, you know, again, look at it from objectively here. We have a young man threatening to kill himself with a knife. The officers definitely did not try to de-escalate the situation, and if anything, probably did escalate it. This is definitely what we do not want. These are people that are in need, and they need help. And what we have to do a better job of in the law enforcement is identifying risk and who is at risk. But the primary goal of the police response, right? I work for Lexapol now. It's a policy company. It's a liability risk management company. But here's the reality. The primary goal of all police response to these situations is to do the right thing for the right reasons, to try to protect that person that needs assistance, to try to protect the officers that are responding to it, and not put themselves unnecessarily at risk. Reduce liability is merely a benefit. It's not the primary motivator. So, you know, we need to apply the proper use of discretionary time to these situations. So is time on your side? Do we have discretionary time? We don't need to belabor this. I hope everybody understands this. It is very, very critical to build this into your training, that if you have a situation that sometimes there is no discretionary time that results in discretionary time, that in other words, things slow down, the situation changes. But this is very, very important. And if officers had recognized that, and not only the Glenn case, but in many other cases, then the Duro case, it may have been a different result. So now we're going to get into priority of life, and we're going to talk about how this applies and how this is overall concept, the overall legal concepts that we've talked about so far. So priority of life involves determining who is at risk and who's causing risk. So we have roughly three different categories of officers involved, or excuse me, of people involved. We have police officers, we have innocent persons, and we have criminal suspects and persons in crisis. Now we have them together. Are they the same? No, they're not the same in the sense of this is priority of life is not about culpability. It's about who's causing the risk and who is at risk. So culpability does not matter. Again, look at the Roel case from the beginning. This is a man in a severe state of crisis, in excited delirium. Is he culpable? Well, that would be a difficult argument to make. However, the state of his actions are what are going to judge the response. And in that particular case, they didn't have a lot of discretionary time as he was advancing on them. So we don't need a, and in reality, too, a person in crisis just can be an innocent person. It's just sometimes life just catches up, and it doesn't even necessarily mean that they're mentally ill. It just means that situationally there's something going on they can't handle right now. So it's best for officers from an officer safety perspective, and that's a huge one, too, is that when you engage with somebody physically, you're much, much more likely as an officer to be injured. This is definitely a high risk area for officers because the people do not feel the pain. So let's just go through a couple very, very quick examples here. So in the first one, you get a call, maybe it's a third party call, maybe the person called a hotline. And, you know, I can't deal with this anymore. I suicidal ideation, officers are dispatched. The person answers the door. There's no signs of weapons. There's no need to, you know, this is an obvious, it should be an obvious one. And this is how the priority of life needs to be analyzed. So are the police officers, who's causing the risk in that particular case? Yeah, arguably you could say that maybe he is causing the risk to himself. However, as the officers go in, he's communicative. He doesn't have any obvious weapons. He's willing to get help. This is clearly a case where there's no need to rush. And, you know, we definitely don't want to be the officer causing the risk. Now, the officer causing the risk in this analysis. Now let's go to the second example. And I'm actually going to use the Casella versus Hughes case, the facts of that with this, which is similar to what I have here on the screen. But what happened in Casella, this is a Supreme Court, recent Supreme Court case. Officers get a call for a woman with a large knife hacking at a tree. So they arrive and they see two women, one walking towards the other with the knife. She matches the description that was given in the original call. And officers give her commands to drop the knife. She stops. She's just a few feet away from the other woman. The other woman is telling her to calm down, telling the officers to calm down. Officers are giving her commands to drop the knife. And they perceive in this particular case, now they're behind a locked fence, so they cannot get through the fence. So they don't have any obvious alternatives here. So in this particular analysis, is there an innocent person at risk? And their answer in their minds, which is not, I don't think, unreasonable, is yes, that she was at risk. You know, without getting into the details of you know, Bill's of the four science learning, but action versus reaction, that woman could have easily had attacked her with a knife before the officers would have had a chance to effectively respond to terminate the threat. So the officer made a decision and fired at the woman with the knife and hit her multiple times. So the Supreme Court, in reversing the Ninth Circuit, ruled that while they didn't outright rule that that was objectively reasonable, they disagreed with the Ninth Circuit by saying, look, this is not, we're not going to go there. We're not going to determine whether it's objectively reasonable, but all we do know this. It also was not clearly established that under those circumstances, this was unreasonable by the officers. So this is it's just a good example of these are the types of cases that they're so difficult and the public doesn't understand that the risk involved here, if the officers did not take action, there was a chance, we will never know what would have happened, but the risk could have been significant to the woman, the innocent person that was involved in this. But now let's transition that. Let's say that didn't happen. And in the third example, let's just say that they are able to get through the fence and she does back away, but she does have the knife and she goes into the house and the officers are able to determine from the woman out front that, yeah, no, she does this, she get, you know, whatever, there's nobody else in the house, there's no threats in there. Well, at this point now, we can slow the whole thing down again. This is where we transition. Originally, it appeared as if there was no discretionary time. Now she's in there. Now we can isolate. Now we can contemplate other strategies, but keep her isolated so that now the last thing that we want to do is escalate the situation by doing an immediate entry and perhaps provoking a situation where not only are the officers or the person at risk, but the officers are at risk. And this is the problem with these cases. And these cases we read about because of the result. The person is shot or otherwise injured by the police. However, what happens, what gets ignored is the process that's followed. And what gets ignored is the fact that in many of these cases, the officers are actually putting themselves at some pretty significant risk of injury. And when you look at the LEOCA data that's out there, law enforcement officers killed and assaulted, the stats are there. There's a lot of officers and there's a lot of detailed information about officers killed, but not so much about officers assaulted, not as much detail, but these are clearly dangerous situations and we need to avoid creating the risk. So just a couple of quick takeaways here before I turn it back over to Bill. So look, if the only person that's causing the risk is the only one that's at risk, then we need to isolate or disengage, slow things down, avoid placing yourself at risk, you know, try not to create through your tactics any type of liability. Now, there's no legal duty to prevent a person from harming him or herself, but once again, I'm not saying that because we want people to just say, okay, bye-bye, we're leaving now. That's not the situation. That might be a situation, depending upon the facts, but we want you to understand this so that, number one, you do not make a tactical decision based on a flawed legal assumption. But number two, we want you to use discretionary time to the best of your ability. So in sum, here's the reality. The law, as it has been interpreted with de-escalation, with Doral, with the fact that the person's mental state is a factor to be considered under a Graham analysis, all of this is entirely, the law is entirely consistent with priority of life. It's a risk-based analysis, and this is something that can be quickly done with officers. And then once you get to that situation where now you are going to engage and try to engage with the person, now Bill is going to tell you about the responsibility zone.
Thanks, Mike. It's always helpful to have a clear encapsulation of the rules of the encounter before we start looking at the tactics and the strategies of the officers involved. So one of the concepts that Force Science talks about in our de-escalation program is the responsibility zone. And it's an old concept, but it initially evolved in the 70s by someone, a very well-known communicator in the 70s named Thomas Gordon. And Gordon called it his problem window, in which both individuals in an encounter have a responsibility to address that encounter, or an obligation or a chance to influence the encounter that existed between them and another person they're dealing with. Gordon primarily looks at the problems that people bring to the situation. We're spinning this a little differently because from our understanding of the encounter that exists between officers and the individuals they work with in the street, is that both permit and have a responsibility for permitting communication and problem solving to occur within that zone. And we call it, therefore, the response ability zone. So both the person and the officer own responsibility for control of the zone or the conceptual area of interaction between them. Both can control the encounter. Now, one or the other can also steal control of the zone, such that they eliminate or severely restrict what the other can do in that zone. For instance, drugs, a serious psychological issue, or extreme emotional arousal can impair a person's thought and communication, thus severely challenging an officer's ability to establish contact, build rapport, influence, persuade, or even tactically operate in that zone. The Lucas Glenn case just discussed illustrates how you need to understand this perspective on the situation, as well as how not to push the zone with a preemptive use of force. You see, if you can't establish contact with a person in crisis, you can't get them to focus on you, to pay attention to you in some format. You can't do anything verbally or psychologically. And by the way, your challenge is not to diagnose, but to figure out how you can cut through their disorganized thinking. Even skilled professionals, psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers, can't immediately diagnose someone. But functionally, if you can establish contact, you can then build rapport, influence, and persuade. First, though, you need to focus on the person's behavior, not their diagnosis. Also look at, where is this occurring? What's their perspective? How do they see you? How do they see the world? And most importantly, if you can discern purpose, if you can figure out why they're doing what they're doing, not from the point of cause, but how they're trying to create something, you'll have a key. You'll have a key to resolving this situation. And I repeat again, functionally, if you can't establish contact, you can't build rapport, you can't influence, you can't persuade, you can't talk to somebody. So we need to look at, what is the purpose? Where is this occurring? Is there any purpose to their behavior? Sometimes there's not. We also tend to see, and this is characteristic of, I think, most human encounters, we tend to see that behavior in the other person is caused by something. But you can't often change what that cause is. You often can't restore relationships that may have caused depression and suicidal ideation in someone. You can't solve financial problems. You can never bring a checkbook big enough to solve some of the financial problems that people have that are in a state of crisis that you meet in the street. So you can't restore relationships. You can't solve financial crisis, but you can still work with the person by understanding how their actions are an attempt to solve a problem. And if you can incorporate that, when possible, into your solutions, you'll then have a golden bridge to guide them toward your solution to their crisis. The suicidal person, for instance, likely isn't even going to react to your threatening them, because that's the very intention of their behavior. So if you have your weapon out for your protection, keeping it below your face level, just as a simple tactic, will allow that person to see your face. And that will then allow you to communicate with them person to person. You see, even having the gun up in front of our face blocks important cues we can pick up from them, and also blocks their ability to read us. And how they read us can be really critical if we're going to be effective with someone. So dropping the gun just below face level could be very helpful if you need to have that weapon out. Also, importantly, if someone's having auditory hallucinations, such as they're hearing voices, many people who have had that delusion in the street say that being able to read the lips of the officer speaking to them allows them to isolate out the officer from their hallucinations, allows them to hear the words the officer is saying because they connect to the person, to the officer's lips. And so that can be a very helpful sort of process for those isolation from crowds and other sorts of things that will allow the officer to be isolated within the person's perceptual framework, and then will allow the officer to have more influence. But remember, sometimes you can't even establish contact. If the person is under the influence of drugs, or too profoundly affected by a psychological issue, or their thinking is so disorganized, they may be unreachable. And here's an illustration.
All right, we are back. That little audio clip training came from a webinar that we attended, and a lot of good information that they were giving us. And we're not going to solve the problems of mental health, and we're not going to be able to train you adequately in mental health emergency response in, you know, 15 or 20 minutes or 30 minutes or an hour in an audio program. But if you'd like more information, contact us at helpdesk@privateofficer.com or give us a call at 704-831-8109. We do a lot of church security training. We do active shooter training. We do all kind of public safety training. But, you know, if you'd like more information, please send us an email at helpdesk@privateofficer.com. We also want to recognize a couple people this week for their heroic efforts. Shirley Damon is being recognized for life-saving after giving CPR at a mall. She works mall security in Indianapolis. And also Charles Scott Taylor. We'd like to recognize him. He received an award for being an advanced officer, taking advanced training, and really putting it to use for his company. So we recognize him as well. If you have an employee, a manager, an owner, or even yourself who'd like to be recognized, send an email to helpdesk@privateofficer.com with that nomination, and we'll contact you and be happy to recognize that person. Let me see, what else do we have? Also, if you're in the Bay Area in California and you're looking for a great company to work for, Valiant Private Security is hiring right now. Call our friends out there, Mr. Libby at Valiant Private Security. Check them out online at valiantprivatesecurity.com today. They have many different positions. They're a great company to work for, a growing company. And, of course, tell them Rick sent you, and that'll get you an instant raise. No, that'll definitely get you an interview and a great job. So make sure that you check them out today. If you're interested in advertising in our newsletters, we have a special offer that we just put out this week. $10, just $10, will get you an ad in our newsletter and on our social media. $10 a week, you can advertise your business, an item for sale, or a help wanted ad. Contact helpdesk@privateofficer.com. So much more that we want to talk about, but time is slipping away. So with that, I'm going to bid you adieu. We'll be back here on Sunday for On the Legal Side. But until then, as always, we want you to be safe, be blessed, and we'll see you back here on the radio.